and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Hot Dogs and Caviar. Pardon my voice. I worked 5 shifts in 3 days behind the bar yesterday, and I sound like crap. This time, it's not the mic. It's the guy using the mic. But, you know, crappy sound quality is just part of the Hot Dogs and Caviar mystique. So this is just a different flavor of crappy sound quality, so welcome aboard. Hold on. All right, so Nate and I were chatting, and he wanted to kick it to me that I was telling a funny story about nicknames, and he's like, you should go ahead and tell this story to everyone. So the thing about restaurants is that they're very nickname intensive environments, and a lot of the stories I won't tell you because they're just awful, but everybody gets a nickname.
Sometimes context matters,
right? Like, we should not tell the Lion Crawl story.
No.
Of which Nate was a lesser known character. How is that neck feeling, by the way?
Dude, I was just going to say my neck still hurts
terribly. And one day,
I think I need surgery.
One day when we're on Patreon and someone wants to give us like $200 in donation, we'll tell that story. Or maybe not. Anyway, the point is, nicknames are not always a reasonable story, but sometimes they're great. The thing about nicknames is that they build camaraderie. Because if you have a bunch of people and you just call them by their first names, it's boring. It's lifeless. But if you have nicknames, and sometimes they can be cruel nicknames, but if you have nicknames for everyone, it builds a sense of team. I mean, it's the reason fighter pilots have call signs. It's I imagine I'm definitely not a fighter pilot, but nicknames are a beautiful thing. So there's this guy that I formerly worked with, and his name is Don, but he was just absolutely the spitting image of the Muppet Lou Zealand. This guy looks it's interesting to look exactly like a Muppet, because most people don't. Most people look like humans, but this guy looks like a Muppet. But the science of a good nickname sometimes is getting everyone behind it before the first person even knows they have it. Like,
There's an art form to this.
So I had the picture on my phone always. And I would just call him Lou, and somebody would be like, why do you keep on calling Don Lou? And then I would show them the picture, and they would immediately start laughing. So I had these two at the bar last night, and Lou's girlfriend was there. And she's like, I never asked, why does Jesse call you Lou? And he pulled up the picture, and she just goes, oh, my God. Oh, my God. Like, she didn't even laugh. She was just like, yup. It was the most amazing thing. But the point is, before he knew I called him Lou just because I did, but I want to clarify that he was a general manager and I was an executive chef. So this was like peer-to-peer ball busting. But he didn't ask. He just took it, because this was a very nickname intensive workplace. So finally, one day he just goes, why do they call me Lou? Why does everyone call me Lou? And I showed him the picture and he just goes, oh, God damn it.
See, now that's the genesis of the whole joke. Like, you told everyone before the person.
Right.
Like, remember how we used to make up spectacular lies about coworkers and try to get the lie to spread? But when you win is when a person goes to the person you're making a lie about and they ask them.
It was like the time that we had that kid that washed dishes, and he was like an all-state basketball player at his high school. And yeah, he was like getting scouted by Marquette. I mean, he was the real deal. And
D1 schools.
And he was, like NCAA. I don't know what became of him, but he was, it's amazing that a guy with such low intensity at work could be a good basketball player, but maybe he used all his energy on the court. Anyway, Nice kid. I don't remember his name, but he was going to go play basketball with one of our line cooks. The line cook was an athletic guy, but not getting scouted by Marquette good. But yeah, we had this kid completely convinced that he was a first team All-American in college. So he went out there and just cut him to pieces. And he came back and he goes, yo, man, Jerry's not that good.
Yeah, stuff like that. You know, not mean lies or anything like that, like ridiculous lies. Like, we had the whole wait staff at a restaurant convinced one of our line cook's mother was Mrs. Fratelli from The Goonies.
Who was that? I don't remember that.
Our buddy Ari, who I just talked to, he was not amused. He was really pissed.
that's the best.
Is your mom Mrs. Fratelli from the Goonies? He's like, what?
Another time, sometimes you can give someone a nickname to piss someone else off. Like, I had this at social, there was a very sort of, I mean this in the nicest way, kind of an alpha bitch bartender server named Carly.
I gotcha.
And she was tall, blonde, beautiful, in charge, just good at her job, kind of abrasive personally, but didn't mind it, just ate it up. Just if she wanted a table to leave, they'd leave. If she wanted a table to be cool and buy another round because their food was taking a long time, she would get that other round out there. Complete stone cold badass server. So we hired a 19-year-old girl who was also named Carly. So we put her on the schedule as Carly number one so that the alpha bitch server was Carly number two. And she didn't think it was funny at all. So this innocent 19-year-old kid that was like in her first ever restaurant job, or maybe not first, but she was really early in her career.
Yeah.
Immediately ran afoul of the most fearsome server on the entire wait staff through absolutely no fault of her own, just from the simple chance of having the same name as someone.
Yes. That's great. Yeah. It's the subtlety.
Nicknames are fantastic.
When the joke is really lost on the person who's the butt of the joke,
even better.
That's how you build camaraderie in a restaurant.
Yeah, there's nothing funnier than someone not understanding why their nickname is funny.
Yes.
And the thing is, nicknames are pretty ubiquitous. Like, I mean,
yeah, it doesn't always happen, and it's got to happen organically. You can't, you know,
like
it's
Nate
tough to force it.
Nate's been called Nate Dog. Just like most people in the world named Nate after Regulators came out, Nate's been Nate Dog for like decades, to the extent that we call his wife Mrs. Dog, and she's guardedly okay with it.
She's all right with it. She's accepted it.
The story about me being called Waitress Cobra is now a matter of public record. But the most recent nickname I had, Commander's Palace, they called me Jesse Big Butt, which... honestly, it's not the fat joke. I give as good as I get. It's the lack of imagination that hurts the most, man. Do better. So that was kind of annoying. But the thing is, the fact that I was annoyed by it made it great for everybody else. And I accept my place in the great circle of life.
Yeah. It's all in how you roll with it.
Yeah. And ultimately, and Nate and I make this disclaimer all the time. It's never about actually hurting anyone's feelings. Never, ever.
No, ever.
It's about building camaraderie. If someone really seemed to like violently hate a nickname, then we would back off. But if someone just seemed to like suffer from mild consternation, that just increases the humor.
Oh, then that's even better. If it's just a slight annoyance or, you know,
and no
little,
one is,
little discomfort, that's fine.
No one is safe. You know, another thing that's fun is when you give like someone just like an extremely cool nickname, just to like, for like Spider. Like we had a guy called Spider. Now, the story of how he got called Spider is not even worth explaining. But everyone's like, why do you call him Spider? And you just start making stuff up.
Uh-huh. You just add to the lore.
Oh man, or Short Round. Like, we had this Japanese-American woman. And we just met her, but her name was Jessie too. So that was annoying me because people kept on calling us over. And I was just like, working on a line next to someone with the same name as you is really irritating. And so I was just like, you're getting a nickname by the end of the day. And she was like, okay, whatever. And then right before service, she tucked her hair into a ball cap. And she goes, and now I become a 10-year-old Japanese boy. And I was like, Grant, what was the name of the little kid from Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom? And he goes, Shorty, Short Round. I was like, all right. He goes, you can't call the new kid that. And I was like, watch me. And so throughout the night, I was mulling over. I was like, this is a racially charged nickname. And is that really okay? I don't want to piss her off. You know, we always err on the side of decency. We joke, but we do. And then she had some Japanese writing tattooed on her forearm. And Spider just goes, "What's your tattoo say?" And she just looks up at him and deadpans, "That was my ID tag from the internment camp." And I was like, "Oh, okay. This girl, this girl's cool." Yeah. So let's hear it for nicknames, man.
Absolutely.
The nickname
good old that I, nicknames.
The nickname that I gave Nate that he hated was I started calling him Bossmaster. And that pissed him off, but it pissed him off more when I got other people to call him Bossmaster, which didn't happen very often because he was visibly annoyed by it. But I was just like, Nate's a very conscientious boss, and he doesn't really like.
I don't even care if people call me chef or I didn't.
He's not the kind of guy that rules at the point of a sword. So giving him an obviously obsequious, ridiculous, self-aggrandizing nickname called Bossmaster irritated the piss out of him. It was great.
Yeah, that was well played.
So that's our funny story, a group of funny stories. And I'm sure we've probably told some of those stories before, but just out there to, this is a shout out to Spider and Teen Wolf and Chachi, and Short Round. And obviously Sarah, who wanted a nickname so bad she never got one. That's right. Love you all. We few, yes. We happy few, we band of brothers. For you sheds his blood this day with me shall be my brother. Hell yes.
Hell yeah.
That was Shakespeare. It was Shakespeare-ish. he wrote books back in the day. They don't have pictures, so you wouldn't know. All right, well, let's move along. Nate and I were talking about what to go through today, and we have a couple of topics, a couple of short subjects. So I want to start off with a drink I learned the other night. I'm bartending. It's really fun. It's super easy and low stress. And most of all, it allows me to continue my restaurant career without physically breaking down from horrible stress injuries, which is what was happening to me in the kitchen. Because being a chef is hard on your body. Nate, back me up.
Oh, yeah. For sure. I got to stretch out like every day before even go to work.
So this dude ordered something that I've never heard of. I don't know if it has a name. It was a 1 ounce pour each of Hennessy, Kahlua, and half and half, shaken and served on the rocks. And it was like halfway between a mudslide and a Brandy Alexander. It was just one of the most delicious things I've ever had. Now, that's not something I would walk into a bar and order because I'd be like, people could see me and I need to get something. I need to get something masculine, like my gin and soda, my beloved gin and soda. But as far as like, so to speak, like sweet after dinner drinks, it was just absolutely fantastic. Just Hennessy, Kahlua, half and half. Like, not something you want to drink all night because it's sweet and fatty. But, like, if you're having, like, a chocolate cupcake and you want a drink to wash it down with, or if you're full after a nice restaurant meal, but you want a little something sweet, but you just can't eat anymore because you ordered, like, five appetizers, this is a way to get something sweet in. It was just absolutely fantastic. I don't know what to call it because it doesn't have a name. But because it's icy and because it's kind of based on the mudslide, my proposal is to call it an ice ball slide after the move combo that made Sub-Zero the most dominant character on the old Mortal Kombat game. So,
oh, that was the name of that move?
Well, there was the ice ball and then the slide. So you'd freeze the dude and then you'd slide at him and knock him over.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. I didn't know that move had a name.
I played a lot of Mortal Kombat when I was 18. So I don't talk about...
I bet you were the dickhead who just leg sweeped the whole time.
No, ice ball slid. Ice ball slide. Ice ball slide. Ice ball slide. You just can't get up from it. It was a combo I called the pain amplifier because it was just so cheap and cheesy. So I don't say the name of the restaurant where I work on the air as a matter of policy. But for those of you who know me, come in and ask for an ice ball slide with your dessert. It's really, really good.
All right.
I mean, it's
really good.
It's kind of like a White Russian. Except that the Hennessy just gives it some depth, like that barrel-aged cognac.
White Russian is vodka instead of Hennessy, right?
Right, right. Vodka, Kahlua, and half and half. So this just replaces the vodka in a White Russian with cognac, and it just makes so much more of it. It's like when you make your basic tomato sauce, but you throw in like a half a can of anchovies. It's just depth. It's a little bit. It's a third dimension to a kind of two-dimensional thing. Because like White Russians are they're for college kids. Like you
Do you like cognac? Do you enjoy it on the rocks or anything? Or you like it as a mixer?
I enjoy cognac neat. It's the only brown liquor I drink. Like, I can't drink whiskey. Whiskeys, I just can't. I'm a disappointment to my whole Southern family. I don't do bourbon. I don't do scotch. I'll do a shot of Jameson, but that's
basically. But you like cognac?
Yeah, I love it. Cognac neat is my thing.
You got any brands you like, or what do you like?
Well, I mean, Hennessy and Courvoisier are great because you can get them at any liquor store and they're perfectly good. Remy Martin is kind of a step up, but it's also a step up price wise. But if you really want to, ball out, Kelt, K-E-L-T is like, that's like the connoisseur's cognac. It's not $1 million. Like everyone talks about Louis Trey. I don't need to pay $500 for a shot of anything ever. As long as I live, nothing's that good. But
no,
Kelt cognac is excellent. And then also another one that's really good, just not specific brand, but just the type of liquor, Armagnac brings the same kind of
thing. I love Armagnac.
It's single distilled, so it's a little more raw, a little more harsh, but it's not a bad kind of harsh. It's just a little bit, it's like one step down towards the whiskey side of things.
I didn't realize, I didn't know it was a single distilled too. I thought it was the same thing, just a different town, really.
It's a different town. Well, the thing is, whenever you're talking about French liquor or wine,
right,
the way they make it is tied to the town. Like if you make a red wine in Bordeaux, you have to use the Bordeaux grapes. If you make if you make a red wine in Burgundy, you want to call it Burgundy, you have to use Pinot Noir. The name controlled thing really keeps everybody on the straight and narrow. And one of the reasons that American wines can be kind of unpredictable is they don't have that. If you're in the Napa Valley, you can label anything you want Napa Valley, even if you're drinking something that even if you're making something that makes no sense in the Napa Valley, like Gewürztraminer. So we're like, that's kind of one of the reasons why I think that European wine, once you get a little bit literate, is more idiot proof. If you buy a Brunello di Montalcino, you know exactly what you're getting. What you're getting. You're getting a high-end Sangiovese from Tuscany. The thing is, it kind of flies in the face of the spirit of American freedom. Like, America's like, we do whatever we want. That's my impression of America. The thing is, the way the Europeans go, their label terms have more value. Champagne is champagne, no matter what. Burgundy is Burgundy, no matter what. And it makes their labels more valuable. That's why they get so pissed off when we make sparkling wine and label it champagne. They hate that shit.
Oh, yeah.
There was an interesting legal case where a cheesemaker from France objected and sued to get Americans to stop making Gruyere-style cheese because it's not Gruyere if it's not from the Alps. And an American judge, surprise, surprise, ruled in the favor of America, but I think it kind of makes sense. And his point was that there's a lot of legal precedent, like cheddar is cheddar. Real cheddar is from England, but there's a million creameries in America making cheddar cheese. So it's kind of absurd. Yep.
And the Parmesan, like I never understood how someone from another country would come here and try to enforce one of their laws. Like, how does that work? Like,
because they're protecting their brand. I see both sides. Like, I see why the French guys.
But how would they even have a case in an American court?
International trade law is a thing. And the thing is, the precedent on the French guys' side is that the wine thing is legit. They've actually managed, like, the U.S. cannot export wine that's mislabeled to Europe. It's illegal. And they've done a little bit of work to sort of tone up labeling laws. That's where the French side had precedent. But the side where the American side had precedent is American cheesemakers have been making cheese in the style of European cheese and calling it that style for like 150 years. And you can't put that cat back in the bag. So he's like, we're not going to carve out an exception for Gruyere. Because the way American cheese
naming works, precedent you don't want to. Yeah.
That's the way. And it was an interesting case because I really did see value on both sides. And it's so rare that an interesting case involves food. But
on the other side of the coin, too, what America has done really good, specifically the state of California, is the California Olive Oil Council is some of the most strict and tight laws in the world. Like if you got an olive oil from California with that olive oil council seal of approval, you know you're getting extra virgin olive oil from this. It's really, really good standards.
Yeah, I think
because olive oil is a really dirty business, especially from Europe. You don't really know what you're getting.
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of mislabeling that happens. Or like if you're an Italian company, right, but you press your olives in Tunisia, you can still label it Italian olive oil in some jurisdictions.
Right.
It's a can of worms. I think with olive oil, ultimately as a chef with olive oil, I like to find brands that I trust and just go with
it. Yeah, there's brands you can trust, but as far as like international labeling, like with like Burgundy and Champagne and Cognac and all that, like you can throw that out with olive oil. Like if you think you're, you know, you're getting it and you never tried it before, like you're rolling the dice.
All right. So this has been an interest. This wasn't even on our itinerary. Just
no, that's like, pretty cool. Pretty cool topic though.
So I got two separate points. One is just real quick. If you're shopping for cheese and you want to make sure you're getting the real French cheese now that it's been or Spanish or Italian or whatever, look for the name control label. Because you can call it Gruyere, but in France, it's AOC. In Spain, it's DOQ. They update them sometimes, but you can find them. There's name control organizations. They all translate to basically the same thing. In Italy, it's DOC or DOCG. Whether it's
IGP too is another one.
Yeah, like there's look up labeling conventions online, or maybe I'll do a quick little glossary on the blog. There are organizations that make sure that the labeling is legit. So if you have American Gruyere, they can call it Gruyere legally, but they cannot put that AOC symbol on there. So
that's a really good, and it's a very strict stamp of approval for like, you know, dairy and wines and things like that. But with olive oil, man, like, whew,
but
I don't
said
know
that,
how they sneak that shit.
Italian, by the way, French or Italian cheese isn't necessarily better. Like there are great American Alpine style cheeses in the style of Gruyere. There are terrific American hard cheeses. There's great American creamy cheeses, but it's still good to know what you're buying.
Yeah. Now you want to know what you're paying. You want to know you're getting what you paid for.
Exactly. It's all about knowing what you're serving. I mean, my wife worked for a French chef in Chicago who had a higher end place that she wasn't really qualified to work at the time. And his cheese plate, the guy was from France. His cheese plate was all from states that bordered Illinois. So they were from Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana. Like they were all local, semi-local, because that was, in his opinion, he's like, the French move isn't to use French cheeses. It's to use what we have here, to use what's around you. And I thought that was sick.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
that's a really good touch.
Because we talked about olive oil for a second, and because buying olive oil is hard, I want to know what your go-to is for expensive olive oil and what your go-to is for cheap olive oil. Hit it.
Cheap olive oil, honestly, I get it from Costco. It's really good.
Me too.
It's really good olive oil. Costco. All their shit is solid.
Costco Rock olive solid. Oil is good. The thing about Costco is they have
cheap too.
They have huge buying power. And that means they could be like, our olive oil is going to be good. Yeah, Costco is terrific olive oil. It's my go-to as well. Like Kirkland Signature Extra Virgin Olive Oil.
It's rolls. Beautiful. That's almost what I use exclusively.
I do keep a finishing olive oil around because I'm
pretentious. What do you got?
Castellus from Aix-en-Provence.
Castellus. I like Terra Bramante too.
Terra Bramante is amazing.
Castellus is awesome. There's a lot of really good ones, but I usually don't keep it around because you want to use it fresh. It's fruit juice. Remember, you want to use it, you know, it'll last a lot longer than, you know, apple juice, but you know what I mean? Like, it's not something you want to keep in the cupboard for 3 years and only pull it out on birthdays. Like, use it.
That's true.
It's expensive.
But the other thing is if it starts getting fugly, you just get another bottle.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. But, you know.
I mean, I'm famously not particularly
I'm talking bad. About at home.
I'm talking about at home, too. I'm the guy that will, like, make dinner. I made a bowl of ramen last week that I'm not going to discuss. It's going to be a whole thing on the blog. I probably put $100 into the dashi. I don't think things through. I had dried fish products getting shipped to me direct from Japan. I overdid it. I went overboard. The dashi was really good. Was it worth it? Absolutely not. But I'm not very value conscious when it comes to food.
I'm not either. I just want to make sure I use it. Yeah. And if I was going to have like a dinner party or something, or like, you know, ball out, like I really like oils, like this is flies in a little bit of a face of the, like a lot of the, you know, common thinking of olive oils, but I like Northern Italian olive oils from Liguria in the Lake District. They are just so beautiful, like closer to the French and Italian Riviera olive oils. Like those are some of the best in the world.
Liguria is right across the border from Provence, and that's where mine comes from. So I'm right there with you.
Oh yeah. I love that. Sicilian olive oils are great, but it's a dirty business, man. I don't have any brands I can stand behind.
I really,
this is what you're going to get.
I prefer fruity olive oils. So I think the north of Italy and southern France is more fruity olive oil territory. As you move south into Campania, it gets peppery. I'm not against it. It's just not.
Against it either. It's a totally different style, different varietal. As far as domestic stuff, I like anything with that California seal of approval on it is going to be awesome. Like Cordo, I love it. I think that's one of the best values going in around.
I don't pop for domestic.
What's
oil.
The one that Limehouse sells?
I don't remember the name.
It's really good.
I don't remember the name of it, but it's pressed from Arbequina olives.
Yeah, Arbequinas are great. Arbequinas.
Yeah, like the olive oil is like wine. There's varietals. It's pressed. Olive oil is super cool, man. I think we would probably lose the audience if we talked for an hour about olive oil. But let's just agree that olive oil kicks ass, and that also we could agree that if you want good olive oil, you just get the Costco stuff. That's how not snobby we are.
Yeah. And don't cook with it. It's kind of a waste of money. I mean, you can, the Costco stuff's cheap enough if you want to like do some really badass frito misto, but it's going to be, you know.
When I was growing up, I roomed with, I've mentioned him on the podcast before, avid listener, Tom DeLuca, his family's Italian, and his mom would send him home with like a flat of tomato sauce, or like canned tomatoes, and like 10 pounds of pasta and a gallon of olive oil. So at my rat ass apartment when I was in college, we cooked everything in olive oil. We did pancakes and extra virgin because we were too broke to go out and get Wesson oil. And I'll tell you what, pancakes cooked that extra virgin. Is it a good use of money? No, but neither was anything else we were doing on the weekend. And I'll tell you what, those pancakes, they were pretty interesting. It gave them a savory edge. So even though you had butter and syrup on them, there was that little olive oiliness. I mean, hell, Mario Batali apparently puts extra virgin in his fryer.
I know a lot of people do that, and they do virgin olive oil. Like the place I was at in Italy, that's all they fried in. I mean, if you can afford it, it's hell yeah, go for it. But yeah,
must be nice. Or like how Michelle.
Yeah, it's just too much.
Like how Michel Richard filled his deep fryer with clarified butter for his French fries. That had to be sick. Oh, it sucks so much that guy died before I got to eat his food. Anyone that's following along, get Michel Richard's book, Happy in the Kitchen. It's a very special.
You need it.
It's a very special combination of a cookbook that where the recipes work, and it's all very well thought out, but it is also a heartfelt work of astounding food pornography.
Agreed.
If you don't
food
have
porn, it's technically sound.
If you haven't read that
book, a lot of gems out of there.
That's not our problem.
Not our problem.
Yeah. Michel Richard, Happy in the Kitchen. I think we mentioned that on the, you haven't read this book, it's not our problem episode.
That wasn't one of ours, but it was close to it.
Well, let's go ahead and add that to the list of books where if you haven't read it, it's not my problem.
Not my problem. Michel Richard.
Beast. All right. Well, that was a fun digression. But I'm just going to go ahead and drag us on to the next topic. All right. Well, our next topic, Nate had this idea and I think it's great. Nate, hit it.
I think, so we want to continue our little blurb series about cooking basics and basic stuff and doing little hacky sack between, you know, homey, more, you know, everyday kind of recipes. And in honor of meatloaf, I think we should do meatloaf. So here we go.
Big meatloaf fan. That guy could
I like meatloaf.
That guy could write the hell out of a pop song.
Yeah, in honor of his passing. Hey, was that refresh my memory? Did meatloaf did he do a stage dive and like bust his skull open or something like that, like years ago?
I haven't heard that story, but it seems like something he'd do.
Like nobody caught him and he fell and he got like gruesomely injured.
Well, I'll look it up and it's either going to be on the blog or I'll edit it out based on whether or not it happened.
All right. I figured if any of my friends could remember it, because I was talking about that and I was like,
A lot of the hot dogs and caviar editing process is me going through our crap and seeing what we're misremembering and what actually happened. All right. Well, so Nate, let's start with some basic meatloaf questions. I'll kick one to you. You kick one to me. So when you make a meatloaf, what is your preferred mix?
At the house, I just usually use ground beef.
Nothing wrong with that.
Occasionally I'll do like a 3-to-1, like beef to like maybe like some Italian sausage or something to just like give it a little depth.
Sexy twist, man. I didn't expect that kind of stuff this early. That's a great idea.
Yeah, it gives us some depth.
Well, because like my grandmother's meatloaf recipe, which is the one that I grew up making, because my grandmother was a very good cook. She liked her meat well done, so her roast beef was like an abomination. But apart from that, she was a very good cook. And she brought me up on her meatloaf, which was a pound of veal, a pound of beef, and a pound of pork. Now,
nice.
In practice, the veal is hard to find and kind of unnecessary. It doesn't really do anything. Ground veal and ground beef are different, but they're not that different. So I have a couple of different moves. Move number one is replace the ground veal with ground lamb. But lamb has a very specific flavor and it kind of drags it in this Mediterranean direction that if that's not where you want to go, then 2-to-1 beef to pork is my normal go-to. And the reason I do that, beef has flavor. You've had a steak. It's robust. It's bold. But pork has interesting properties when it comes to like grinds. Pork protein forms a protein web very easily. It's why most sausage is made of pork. And it's why beef sausage doesn't always have a very good texture. Pork is magic. Pork holds moisture and salt if you agitate it with salt. It holds moisture. There's a reason why when you cook an Italian sausage, or any kind of sausage, when you cook a sausage in a pan, it doesn't bleed out fat. Whereas when you cook a burger in a pan, it does bleed out fat. It's because of pork's magical qualities of protein matrix. So adding some pork to the mix means your meatloaf will have an improved texture at the cost of a little bit less flavor, because ground pork really doesn't taste like much. But the textural bonus is there. Now, what this motherfucker just came at me with is adding Italian sausage. That is a lazy man's masterstroke, because it's
easier than just using the ground pork and it's already seasoned up a little bit.
That's so good, dude. That's so good. And you know what? It's funny, I didn't think about this, but there was a bar in New Orleans called Fat Harry's, and their signature burger had Italian sausage in the burger mix, and that burger was absolutely sick. The bar was disgusting. It was like the worst bar in the world. Like, you went into the bathrooms, and it didn't have regular porcelain toilets. It had those metal toilets they have in jail cells. Like, but they had cheap drinks, and there was a Ms. Pac-Man machine, and their burger was awesome. I haven't thought about that burger in a long time. That is some next level shit. You have just totally defeated me at what is your meat mix. All right. So that was good. Good stuff, man.
No, and good thoughts on the pork and the webbing matrix and how it retains moisture. It really helps.
I'm really into sausage making, and sausage making and meatloaf making are not that different. Okay. No. Well, let's talk about filler. So in meatloaf, you have to have some breadcrumb. Otherwise, it's not meatloaf. Right. Listeners, have you ever noticed how like a slice of meatloaf is moist and delicious, whereas a well-done hamburger sucks? The reason is because meatloaf has panade, which is just a fancy way of saying bread product. So, Nate, why don't you hit me with some of your panade ideas? What do you put in your meatloaf to be bread?
Well, really sticking with the low-carb, no-sugar thing. So I've been using ground-up pork rinds. That's a really nice filler.
Oh my God.
It's awesome. But then, you know, when panko is wonderful, I've used
I'm embarrassed at how often I use panko, because it's kind of soulless, but it's also easy.
So versatile. It's so easy.
Like you always have a 5-pound bag of panko where you work.
Yep. And you know, I like ground up crackers. Like,
you were about to say, I think you were about to say pretzels, right?
pretzels, ground up pretzels.
Damn, that's
good. There's all kinds of different cool little panades you can add into it. And you don't even have to go like 100%. You could just do like a 50-50 blend of like Cheez-Its and panko or something. And it's pretty good.
I've got two thoughts. I've tried them both and they're both amazing. One of my first cookbooks I ever bought when I decided I wanted to take cooking seriously was I got the Sylvia's Soul Food book out of New York City. I don't even know if the restaurant's still open, but there was a soul food place in New York called Sylvia's. They used to have her barbecue sauce on the shelf at the grocery store. I was 18. I was a kid. And it was a cookbook that was like just my speed. It cost about 13 bucks. It was about 150 pages long. You know, it was a good training wheels. I wasn't ready for the French Laundry cookbook yet. Her meatloaf, she made it with yesterday's biscuits.
Ooh, that sounds awesome.
So like biscuits are fatty. Like, you know, there's lard or butter or even Crisco in there. So like yesterday's biscuits, when they get all old and shitty, bung them through the meat grinder or in the food processor, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And that makes a good panade. But the other panade trick I have is a gluten-free one. And it's going to sound stupid, but it works its ass off. And that is Rice Krispies. If you need to make a gluten-free meatloaf, Rice Krispies is the panade of choice. Like, I mean, like the breakfast cereal, like Snap, Crackle, and Pop, Rice Krispies. Add that for your panade. It's all rice. I'm pretty sure it's gluten-free. You want to check the label because sometimes...
Sometimes they process it in the same...
Right. So if you're gluten allergic, read the label and be smart. But if you need to make celiac meatloaf, Rice Krispies are the bomb.
Hell yeah. Nice.
So that's my little trick there.
Nice. Speaking of barbecue sauce, so some of my seasonings, I always put barbecue sauce in it, ketchup. I like to put Old Bay. Lean Perrins, Frank's, you know, real standard stuff.
I'm a big believer in Worcestershire sauce, Lean Perrins, although I got to tip the
Bulldog.
Hat. Bulldog. I've switched. Bulldog, Worcestershire sauce. Me too, dude. I never thought you'd switch. Nate is such a brand whore. Like,
I switched. I go Bulldog.
I've said this before, but he used to make me spec Heinz white vinegar for distilled vinegar, which is objectively insane, but I did it because it was my job. He was the chef. I was his underling, and I did my job every day. But
I still buy it.
Nate is a brand guy. And so for him to switch Worcestershire sauces blows my fucking mind. But Bulldog.
Kind of like the Bullard's hot sauce.
Oh my God, that stuff is awesome.
Isn't it awesome?
Yeah. But so
I can have an open mind.
You can, but it takes a truly amazing product.
You just really got to blow my skirt up, you know?
So Heinz ketchup, obviously.
Heinz, yes, obviously.
Now, I think for barbecue sauce versus ketchup, it's kind of an either or thing for me. Like, do you want to make a barbecue flavored meatloaf or do you want to not make a barbecue flavored meatloaf? For barbecue sauce, I assume you're still with Sweet Baby Ray's.
Standard. Yes. Standard. That's the par.
There we are. There's that brand whore. Sweet Baby Ray's is delicious. And like ketchup, it's super sweet, but unlike ketchup, it doesn't do as good a job of like disguising that. But I always like ketchup and meatloaf.
I don't always put the Sweet Baby Ray's in there, but
that's a stylistic choice because that makes your meatloaf taste like barbecue. But on the other hand, why not?
You could go mustard base. Like there's
mustard, Dijon mustard and barbecue in meatloaf is really good.
Yeah.
But yeah, those like this, the flavoring agents that I have, Worcestershire, ketchup. I don't do the barbecue one, but I like the idea.
It's decent. I haven't done it in years, but it's
Worcestershire, pretty good. Ketchup, Dijon. I also like to make a vegetable mix. And when I do this, celery, carrots, not carrots, celery, onions, garlic, and put them in the Roboco and blast them and then just sweat them in a hot pan with like either no fat or almost no fat just to kind of like soften them a little bit because they're going to cook in the loaf, but they're not going to cook that much. And this is a little known fact. Oh, here's a real tip. If you put raw garlic or onions into something like a sausage or a pate, they will take the fuck over. And the next day, it just tastes like garlic and onions. If you give them a quick 60-second saute in a hot pan, you dull that edge, and it doesn't kill the flavor. It makes the flavor more willing to play with other flavors. So that's a super important technique when you're making sausage.
Exactly what I was going to bring up. Perfect. Like, that's exactly how I do it. I do a sofrito. and I cook it down slow and low. I cook them soft. And then I just find that it doesn't take over as much, but it's also like gives you more control of your farce.
For those following
better moisture and better moisture management.
For those following along, particularly those who have commented that we don't explain terms that are not in common usage, sofrito in Italian means low fry. Same thing in Spanish. And so that just means all the aromatics, your garlic, your onions, your fennel, carrots, whatever you want to do, peppers, depending on what the dish is going to be, you cook them in like olive oil, low and slow until they're just totally mush. That is a very valid technique. It just takes a long time, and I'm impatient, and I'm already making meatloaf, but the quick blast works, but the sofrito works more.
You can even buy a jar of sofrito.
Can you really?
Yeah, they sell that.
Huh.
Like I don't know if it's good. I've never tried it. I've never tasted it. I don't know, but they sell it.
I am frankly highly suspicious.
I mean, if you're looking for a 30-minute, you know, meal here,
yeah,
throw together on a busy weeknight.
Well, so we've covered what you put in your meatloaf. We've covered flavoring agents. We've covered panade. Oh, and then obviously whole eggs.
Whole egg. Yep.
By the way, this episode of Hot Dogs and Caviar is featuring Nate's dog, Roxy, on backing vocals.
That's right. Yeah, she's very spooked right now.
It's fine. Sometimes the dog is going to be on the podcast. We had Tarver's kid on last week. yeah, eggs are...
It's the garbage truck.
The garbage truck is clearly an existential threat.
Yes.
The way to make meat, the most basic way to make meatloaf, this is another tip I have. If you want to make meatloaf with no recipe, if you're freestyling, if you just have some ground meat you want to use, this is it's the same way I make meatballs. Take the meat and then add like a couple eggs per pound, maybe two or three eggs per pound, and then mush it all up till you get like wet meat mix, and then add breadcrumbs back in until you get something you can form. That's the method. You don't need to measure.
That's the method, yeah.
You don't need to measure anything. If you're making, that's how you make meatloaf.
And then cook a little test piece off.
Oh my God, that's such an important point.
Check your seasoning.
Hit that harder. Take us through the whole thing because that's important.
So like you got your meat mix, you got your eggs all whipped up and folded in. You're adding your breadcrumbs, getting it to form. Before you bake the whole thing off, get a little pan and cook off a little nug to test your seasoning. You really need to test it because, you know, you might need more salt, more pepper, more garlic, whatever, you know, test it off.
Yeah, absolutely. That's super important because as like meatloaf is hard work. Even if you're not grinding the meat yourself, it's still a pain in the dick. And there's nothing that sucks worse than pulling your meatloaf out and realizing that you add too much salt. Mm-hmm. Too little salt, you can season the slices. Too much salt, you're fucked. Start over. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess a way that I would say it, salvage meatloaf, if you don't want to waste food, take your oversalted meatloaf, bust it up in a pan, add a can of nice canned tomatoes, and stir it until you got a ragu. But
yeah, something like that.
You didn't want a ragu, you wanted meatloaf.
That's right. It's and good I would tricks. Are you a glazer? Do you like to glaze it?
Oh yes. Oh yes.
I like to do an egg white and equal parts yellow mustard, brown sugar, and ketchup. And then the whites solidify and it's all crackly and crusty.
That's good. It's more complicated than what I do. I'm a white trash piece of shit at the end of the day. So I have usually just take the top part of the loaf and just Heinz ketchup, how it starts, like when you bake it, it starts to caramelize and it makes that like, dude, caramelized ketchup is an underappreciated thing.
So if you want to caramelize it even more, fold a white into it.
I'm so doing that. That's a great trick. The other thing I really enjoy.
And it'll help it bind to the top better too.
I'm doing this. I don't know when I'm going to make a meatloaf, but this is happening. But the other trick that I like, because I'm a fat fuck from North Carolina and I likes my pork, bacon wrapped meatloaf is amazing.
Yeah, that's killer.
Especially if it's at a restaurant where you want to like kind of show out, then the bacon wrap is the key.
Here's a tip for you too, before you get your pan. So I like to use like a Pullman loaf pan, something with like pretty high sides, spray it or oil it and then dust it with your crumbs and then take a piece of parchment paper that's big enough and crinkle it all up into a ball, really tight ball. Okay. And then open it up and then put it in there. And then all the little folds in the paper will help you get the corners a little better. And then spray it again, and then put your loaf in there. The paper won't burn, don't worry, and you'll thank me when you're cleaning that pan later.
That's good. And another little trick that I have that's a really unnecessary tip is after your meatloaf is out and cold, chilled, because you can't slice it when it's hot. If you want to serve it right out of the pan, if that's dinner, that's fine. But if you want to do this at a restaurant and you want to make nice clean slices, you do it when it's cold. And then you can take the meatloaf and put it into a nonstick pan. If it's bacon wrapped, you could take the meatloaf and put it into a nonstick pan and render the bacon on the outside, and it'll make it more crispy.
Nice. A good way too. So if you're talking about tricks to getting ahead of yourself, or you know, you want to make a meatloaf on Sunday and eat it maybe like Wednesday night or something on a busy night. So after it's done, I do it at about 400 and I cook it to about 155 because it'll carry up. Let it sit and then lift it out while it's warm, and then wrap it while it's still warm in the plastic wrap, and that'll help maintain the moisture and it'll stay more juicy. Then cool it down. You know what I'm saying? Wrap it while it's still warm. That's a good trick.
That sounds delicious.
Like, do that for your banana bread and your zucchini breads and all that. It'll help keep it a lot moister. It's a really cool trick.
That's good. I like that. Let's see. How about what's your move for leftover meatloaf?
I like searing it off.
Oh yeah.
I don't know, man.
Cut slice. Dredge.
I'm just kind of into just reheating it as is too. Like,
cut, slice, dredge both sides in Wonder Flour.
Oh, I've never done that.
Make them crispy in a hot pan, and then put it on a burger bun with raw onions, more ketchup, some mayonnaise.
You're a madman. I've never done that. That sounds awesome.
Do you remember the time Jordan ate a 6 inch by 6 inch by 6 inch cube of meatloaf spread on all sides with Duke's mayonnaise in 10 seconds?
Yes, I do.
That was disgusting.
That was disgusting.
And kind of awesome. And
totally awesome. I don't know how he got it in his mouth.
The kid could unhinge his jaw like a snake. The kid can eat anything.
I know. That was really impressive. Any other general, remember, good today, better tomorrow is a good rule of thumb to apply to your meatloaf.
Yeah.
You know, there's no wrong rules.
I think that the biggest thing with meatloaf is that, at least the biggest thing that separates, you know, the professionals from the amateurs with meatloaf is if you get ready to grind your own meat, that's kind of the next level. Like, mm-hmm. The reason I point that out is because you don't need to take it there. There's so much ground meat available. Meatloaf is a food for everyone. If you're some fancy chefy guy, you can be like Wolfgang Puck and put ground eggplant in your meatloaf. But you know what? That meatloaf was never all that good. Like,
yeah.
His meatloaf was like eggplant and rosemary were the major flavors in meatloaf. It was pretentious. Like, meatloaf is something you could toss off in an hour and a half, and a lot of that's cook time. And during that cook time, you could be sitting on the couch, drinking beer, and watching sports like an American. And on that note, the Super Bowl is it next Sunday or the Sunday after? No, Pro Bowl's next Sunday. Super Bowl's the Sunday after, right?
Yeah, 2 weeks.
So the Super Bowl's coming. But by the time this gets edited, Super Bowl's probably going to be next Sunday. So we were going to have a few words about party snacks. And
you got any dips you like or anything like that? Like,
I have a blue cheese dip that I'm a big fan of. It's kind of a pain. You get creme fraiche, like Vermont butter and cheese brand creme fraiche. They have it at Whole Foods. It's stupidly expensive. Don't argue with me. And you take the creme fraiche and you whisk it, and it whips like cream. It doesn't really gain volume, but it, like, when you whip cream, you agitate the proteins and they gain viscosity. It makes it thicker. So you whip it until it'll loosen up first because it's what they call shear thinning, which means like when you whisk it, it sort of breaks up and gets thinner. But then the shear thinning will stop and it'll shear thicken and become more thick. Then you add just enough buttermilk to where it's kind of a spoonable thing again. And then you take a really good crumbly blue cheese, like Roquefort you can get at the grocery store, but even just Danish blue or like Cisco crumbles work just fine. Or you can be a total badass and do Rogue River, but honestly, Danish blue or Cisco crumbles, or like Stella is a good brand, just any blue cheese crumbles. And you don't mix it in a lot. You crumble it in so the blue cheese is like chocolate chips and a cookie. You know, so you have mostly just a creme fraiche dip, but then like little bits of blue cheese in there. Then you take an onion and you give what Nate taught me as the Brunwow. This guy has a way of fine dicing an onion that's so completely wasteful and so completely psycho. And the only way I've diced a bread onion since he taught me, I'll put a picture up on the blog. I'll actually do this where you cut off a face of the onion, like one of the curves. So you have this hump shaped slice of onion and then square it up. And then with a sharp knife, you can cut it into extremely precise dice. And it's super easy. I mean, you have to have a sharp knife and you have to trust your skills, but it's super easy. And you know, like when you bite into a big piece of red onion, it can like really take over and be kind of like hot and peppery and nasty. When the red onion is cut like this, when you bite into it, it just becomes part of the cord. So that's it. Creme fraiche, buttermilk, blue cheese, onion, Brunwow, pinch of black pepper, salt if necessary. Although if your blue cheese is salty enough, you might be okay. And that's it. And that is a dip it's useful for chicken wings, chicken fingers, French fries, celery sticks, heaping on a burger. You could pile some on top of your meatloaf sandwich if you're going to have cold meatloaf for the Super Bowl. That's my go-to dip. How about you, dog?
Nice, man. Nothing too crazy. Kind of fell back in love again with pimento cheese. I haven't made that in a long time.
You make the best pimento cheese I've ever had.
Really?
Yeah.
Thanks, well, man.
I want to qualify that by pointing out that a lot of pimento cheese sucks.
Yeah, it does suck.
Having said that,
a lot of it does suck.
You make a very, very good one.
All right. I'll share the recipe for the blog. Pimento cheese, like I smoked some peppers the other day and put it in instead of like
You badass.
It was really good. And then sometimes I'll take the pimento cheese and take like some roasted chicken and fold roasted chicken and pimento 50-50 and make like a buffalo chicken dip. So then I'll add like blue cheese, some mayonnaise, some sour cream, and then Brunwow of carrots and celery because it's not buffalo. And then of course, Frank's has to be Frank's or Bullard's. I will accept Bullard's now. stuff like that, you know.
That sounds delicious, man.
I like a good banya cauda. That's really good, and that's kind of different.
Okay, so just to catch people up, pimento cheese, if you're not from Charleston, is a curious dish, condiment, dip. It's hard to explain exactly what it is. It's
kind of.
Imagine if someone made a nice tuna salad with some peppers in it, except instead of, they were like, oh shit, I'm out of tuna. And they used grated cheddar cheese instead. That's the best way I can explain it. It's like,
that's a really good way of
like,
putting it.
It's like shredded cheese dressed with mayonnaise and pimento, like hot peppers. And Nate's secret weapon, as far as I remember, was the juice from Cornichons.
Yes.
Cornichon juice. French cucumber pickles. It's like this mustardy, vinegary, tarragon-y juice. And that's what separates Nate's pimento cheese from all the over-rich, over-fatty, ass-pointless pimento cheeses I've stuffed into my face over the years. And, like, I mean, some people put, like, garlic and onion powder in there. Not a fan. Like, a very good pimento cheese is excellent. I like it best just smeared cold on a hot biscuit.
Yeah, I mean, it's good. I mean, I don't have it that much, but I had a hankering for it and made a batch. It's delicious.
I will say this. At one place I worked, pimento cheese was always abbreviated on the prep list, pimp cheese. And once you start thinking pimento cheese is pimp cheese, you can't undo it.
Oh, yeah. But I like a good banya cauda. That's a little different, and it's really easy.
Banya cauda is just you mix olive oil and butter and then just dissolve anchovies in it. I mean, do you
pretty
have any
much,
other?
Yeah.
And that's it's a little loose for what Americans think of as a dip. Cause like Americans want like to dip their chip in and have a big wad of fatty stuff on it. Banya cauda is more of, it literally means warm bath. It's just a fatty, oily substance that you just dip vegetables in, and it's goddamn delicious.
See, what I've started doing is making almost like a mayonnaise out of it and emulsify eggs.
Yeah, like that's
make
great.
The bath, and then it's more clingy and thicker.
No, I remember the dish where you came up with that. Because, once again, featuring Roxy on backing vocals.
Dog.
I remember when you took the banya cauda and you put it in you made mayonnaise out of it, and then you put it in a foam gun, and we used it as an aerated banya cauda as a dip for crudité. I forgot about that dish. That dish was the shit.
That was good. yeah.
I mean, anytime you can take a plate of raw vegetables and dress it up with a serious amount of animal fat and anchovies, you're doing the right thing. Objectively. Objectively.
I mean, it's right by me. That's what I like.
Oh, it's so good, man. So good.
So easy.
Well, what are the good party foods you got?
I don't know. You ever make this is so dumb. You know, I do like those rye bread dips in the bowl. I've never made one, but they're freaking good.
I'm not familiar.
What is that? What is in the filling? Like caraway and dill and probably just sour cream. I don't know.
I have no idea what you're talking about. But
you've never had a bread dip bowl? A bowl?
No. Have you ever had a rye bread dip?
Like in a loaf of bread.
Oh, like you hollow a loaf out and put
Yeah.
Well, that sounds delightful. I've never encountered it. That sounds like a really great white trash party snack.
It's totally
and
white.
Let's just agree that white trash party snacks are some of the best.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh my God. Okay, I've got two for you. First off, you know about this because you turned me on to it. But if we're talking about commercial dips, how about that hell of a good French onion dip?
Oh, except no other.
A hell of a good French onion dip is magical. You just sit
down.
I grew up
right down the road from that factory. I love that place.
But they have it at Harris Teeter in South Carolina, which is great.
Yeah, it's all over the place.
You sit down.
Their cheese curds are really good, too.
They don't have those here. But the hell of a good dip
I know,
they do.
They're hard to find.
You sit down with a bag of Low Country Kettle potato chips. I'm giving a plug because my old sous chef, Dandy Andy, owns a potato chip company, and they're awesome.
They are awesome.
You sit down with some Low Country Kettle potato chips. And a can of hell of a good dip and a tall boy of Bud Ice. And that's a 3-course meal that can contend with anything I've had in New York City. Not really. That's actually not accurate, but Eric Repair, if you're listening, La Bernadette is still my favorite restaurant. but then I got another one. I got a party snack that I learned. Okay. So I've disparaged my wife's family's cooking on many an occasion. Because a lot of it's pretty tragic. But, oh my God, they do this thing and it's so trashy. It's so amazing. Like, it's so simple. It's so simple. They take a bottle of chili sauce, like Heinz chili sauce, which is like ketchup with added spices, yep. and a jar of grape jelly. And they mix them and then add a pack of cocktail wieners. And put them in the crock pot.
What?
Hold on, I'm getting it wrong. What? I said it. Hold on, I do a school to be on the recipe. It's Heinz chili sauce, grape jelly, and cocktail wieners in the crock pot till it's all hot. And it is triumphant. I just eat them all day long. Little sweet, spicy cocktail dogs. And it's funny because, like, I grew up with, like, parents that didn't cook. And Dee grew up with like an extended family that cooked, but in like central Illinois church picnic food, which is not my favorite cuisine. But these little cocktail wieners with grape jelly and Heinz chili sauce, they are the light and the truth. Like a big pile of those and then a big pile of potato chips and some hell of a good dip. It's so easy.
That sounds spectacular. I gotta try that.
Oh my God, it's so easy.
You know what else I kind of like that's kind of trashy? Like just taking the canned artichokes and mixing it with some mayonnaise and breadcrumbs and Parmesan cheese, like grated cheese. Mix it up and bake it and it gets all greasy.
You mean from noted producers like Belgioso or Polio, that Parmesan cheese? Hell yeah.
World renowned.
You know, there's it's funny because
I like that shit too.
It's funny because like remember the warm goat cheese.
What about
remember the warm goat cheese that hit the scene in the 90s where if you just took like a number 4 scoop of just whipped regular this like Laura Chanel, you know, corporate goat cheese or Montrachet or whatever, and you just put it in like a baking dish with a ladle of tomato sauce around it and baked it and then you served it with like baguette. That was like high-end cuisine.
Roll it in chopped nuts.
But if
and
you do
keep it warm.
But if you do the same thing with like cream cheese and minced up artichokes and garlic powder and mayonnaise, It's super trashy. Like, it's the same dish.
It's the same shit. And it's so good. You get your townhouse, Keebler townhouse crackers.
Of course, you dork.
Of course. Or like the seven layer taco dip.
Oh, taco dip. Taco dip is the key. It's like everything that goes in a burrito, but you couldn't get around to making the burrito. Like a layer of rice and a layer of spicy taco meat, probably seasoned with taco seasoning, because let's be real, it's not Mexican, but we all use it. And then like a layer of refried beans, and then a layer of cheese, and then a layer of like salsa, and like not salsa you made, like maybe like probably paste picante sauce.
Like Ortega.
Ortega's really good, man.
It is good.
Or like if you really want to be fancy, you get the green stuff that they sell at the Mexican market, but it's honestly just the same. And or you know what? Rick Bayless sauces are no joke. Like Rick Bayless brand, really? Frontera brand salsas, they're really good. You can find them at the grocery store. And then like, and then like a layer of like guacamole, and then you bake all that. And then when it comes out, you top it with shredded lettuce, and you know what? That's awesome. That and
this
some
stuff
corn chips.
Is gutter, and I love it.
I don't even know if there's seven layers there, but I don't care. The thing is, if I'm watching the Super Bowl, I'm probably lights out wasted anyway because I don't care about football. And that is exactly.
Are you gonna go to Del Posto and make sure there's 100 layers in your lasagna? No, it's no. Awesome, and you don't care.
Yeah, it's called seven-layer dip. It doesn't matter if there's seven layers. But if you were going to supercharge seven-layer dip, what would you do?
Oh, man, supercharge it. Maybe take like some really sharp cheddar and melt it down with some like sodium citrate and like make it like super ooey and gooey and like add some like jalapeno juice, and then maybe take like some banana peppers and make like a pepper fluid gel and do like a fluid gel layer on there.
That sounds excellent. It also
maybe
sounds
some,
like
some puffed snacks in there, like some puffed rice or something. That might be good.
I mean, how about topping it with a layer of pork rinds?
Yeah, or pork rinds. What would you do? I don't know.
I'm going to take it back to the meatloaf conversation, and I'm going to cut back 1/3 of the ground beef with some Mexican chorizo.
Ooh. Oh, you know what would be good is to take like some top round or something and slice it super, super thin and keep it raw and get like little bites of like raw beef and cooked beef in there. I wouldn't leave it out too long, but it'd be delicious.
This is amazing. But yeah, like some of that like spicy Mexican chorizo all in there.
Yeah, like a tartare almost.
That's awesome. Yeah.
beef tartare with all those flavors.
we only have like 5 minutes more. Can you think of any other crazy party foods that are awesome?
Let me think here.
I mean, obviously on this blog, we've covered wings. We've covered wings well. You know how we feel about wings. We are both wing men. Nate's from upstate New York. I got my start cooking chicken wings. Oh, let's take a brief moment to bid the... Let me jump topics. I'm going to close this out.
All right. Because if you think my dog is loud, wait till my kids get home.
No. I got this. I'm going to jump topics. I got a perfect thing to close out on. So that's a great discussion of party food. I promise neither Nate nor I are stoned in the slightest. I've had a couple of beers. He's over there being a clean living. But yeah.
I'm sober as a judge.
I'm sober as a bird. That's what happens when a couple of chefs get together and just start talking about trashy party food. When it comes to trashy party food, I think we can look no further than wings as the gold standard. They are a pain in the dick to make at home. That's a fact.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, buying a hotel pan of them from like a wing place that does catering is a good option. And you can reheat them in the oven. And there's nothing in the world that goes better with beer. And that's why I want to take a moment to mourn the passing of another non-meatloaf institution. Nate Whiting, they have closed D.D. Peckers.
What?
Anyone that knows D.D. Peckers, it is probably...
Not my peckers.
It's the best restaurant in the American Southeast. Like, by a certain metric. By a certain metric.
It's a great hangout.
There's better
food. Is it because they found out they were Philly fans?
the fact that they're Philly fans, I can live with. Like, I mean,
yeah, I like that place.
Yeah, there's like no worse group of people in the world than Eagles fans, except maybe Phillies fans. And there's a lot of crossover. Like, people from Eastern Pennsylvania.
Oh, and the Flyers? Oh, they're just the worst.
People from Eastern Pennsylvania are just generally dicks. But man, Dee Dee Pecker's was the best wing joint I've ever been to. The wings were so good.
They did it
good.
Right, man.
They did it right. And they closed for a reason that you can't predict. The building got sold. So they were doing good. They weren't losing money. But Pecker's is done forever. And Nate and I could tell you how many times we have like planned on going somewhere else and then ended up at Pecker's because the wings are perfect.
Great vibe. It's cool, man.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it was a great vibe, but occasionally the place would fill up with Eagles fans, and then it was, you know, an Eagles bar. But at least it was an Eagles bar with perfect food. Like, it was an Eagles bar that I loved so much I went there once a week, even though it was an Eagles bar. That says something.
But that does say something.
There's a potential silver lining. You remember Melly, Mama, the chef?
Yeah, the real feisty lady.
The real feisty lady is a great way to describe her. she, as soon as she found out they were closing, she got on the phone and she got hooked up with a job at Hunley's down the street.
Bills Bar.
Which is a Bills Bar, which I thought you'd be excited about. By the way, I just want to reiterate that the Bills got robbed. That was bullshit. The NFL sucks. Anyway, and I'm not a Bills fan. I just like good TV. And that was, I said it last week, I'll say it again, the most anticlimactic 3 minutes of football following the most amazingly bombastic 20 minutes of football I've ever seen in my life. The NFL sucks. The Bills should have at least had a chance. So Melly is going there.
I don't want to talk about it.
I mean, I said all this on the last episode.
I know. We went over it.
I want baseball season back so bad. But anyway,
soon.
Melly from Dee Dee Pecker's is going to Hunley's. I don't know how much of the menu she's going to bring, but if she brings those hot garlic wings, then you and I have a new spot. And I'll have to deal with being around a bunch of Buffalo fans who, while they are annoying hooligans to a man, are not as bad as Eagles fans. That's just a fact.
They're the best fans in the world. What are you talking about?
Didn't you tell me once that you had to be careful not to wear an opposing jersey when you went to a Bills game or you would get a beer thrown on you or get in a fight?
Oh, absolutely.
Is that what makes them the best fans?
Yeah. They're very territorial.
You fucking New Yorkers are all the same. All right, well, we are about out of time. But yeah, tip the 40 for Dee Dee Pecker's. And if I was allowed, I would play Hard to Say Goodbye by noted Philly band Boyz II Men as my mournful funeral ode. Unfortunately, definitely the FCC will be like, hey, we're going to take your podcast down because you stole that music. But so I'm not going to do that. But everyone at home, if you like Dee Dee Pecker's, put on Hard to Say Goodbye and think about those hot garlic wings because they were the best food.
Well, let's hope they find a new location or they want to keep it going.
Yeah, I mean, let's hope so. Or let's hope that Melly brings it at Hunley's because I've never wanted to go to that bar before and now I do.
Fair enough.
She can flat out cook. And
yeah,
no
that broad
one,
can cook, man.
And no one's better at busting balls behind the bar. No one.
Agreed.
All right, so this one's for Pecker's and this one's for Melly. Really, I cannot overemphasize it, Buggy, how much Nate and I love this bar.
That is a great bar. Well, it was.
Nate had to be very careful not to wear a Mets shirt while he was in there.
Yeah. But I respect that. I respect the rules.
Yeah. Yeah. You're a Mets fan until you are like, you like the Mets, you like the Braves. There's another girl that I used to go there a lot with who was a big Braves fan. But once you walk through that place, you better stop being a Mets or a Braves fan or they'll pick their meat from your bones. But on the other hand, the hot garlic wings, man.
It's worth taking the Mets hat off to go get some badass wings.
Yeah, it is. It is. Not a lot of things are worth like doffing your colors. It reminds me of Manny's Deli on the south side of Chicago, where my friend was like, put your jacket on. I had a Cubs shirt on, and he's like, no, seriously, put your jacket on. They won't serve you.
Yes. Gotta love that. Gotta love it.
Well, here's to the combination of sports and food, which I feel like might be a worldwide thing.
Has to be.
I mean, I love fine dining. I love Mission Stars, but man, I love party food.
Me too. It's all good. Anything done right's worth doing.
Damn right. And the thing is, the name of the podcast is Hot Dogs and Caviar. We take you through the highest end. We take you through the lowest end. If you want to sit at La Bernadette and eat one of the best Michelin 3-star meals of your life, or if you want to sit on the couch in your underpants eating Cheetos and drinking Bud Ice, those are both equally valid gastronomic experiences.
Yeah, and we love you both. We could totally get down with either. We don't care.
You're all members of the Hot Dogs and Caviar family if you could dance to that tune. All right, speaking of tunes, Speakeasy's going to play us out of here. I mean, have fun watching the Super Bowl. Just do what I do. Get blackout and eat a bunch of food because no one cares. The NFL's stupid. But if you happen to be like a Bengals or a Rams fan, then, you know, just when halftime comes, don't watch the halftime show. It always sucks. Go into the kitchen and load your plate up.
That's as good. That's as good a move as any.
Yeah. All right. Well, Speakeasy's going to play us out of here. And I think that calls it a week for this episode of Hot Dogs and Caviar. For Nate Spincake Whiting, I am the waitress Cobra.
Meatloaf rules.
Meatloaf rules. I would do anything for the Woodlands. Remember that?
But I won't do that.
No. we'll explain that joke one day.
One of our many song parodies.
That would be a good funny story. Have we covered the Oompa Loompa song?
No, next week.
Oh, next week we'll do the Oompa Loompa song. Okay. All right, guys, have a fantastic week. Thanks for listening. We'll see what of this ends up on the cutting room floor. Mr. Dog, you have a fantastic rest of your day.
You too. Thanks so much.
Yeah, man. Cheers. Hot dogs and caviar, y'all.
My little darling, my little sister. Come on, baby, just keep your head up. Come on, baby, just keep your head up.